Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntress here. Sorry it's been a while since we've had a new episode. Not since the Bendis tapes, which I put out right around Thanksgiving. Got sick, got busy, feel better. Happy to bring you today's episode. It's Mark DeMatteis, of course, J.M. DeMatteis, to the people who are looking at the credits of comics. You know Mark's work. I mean, what a great run on Captain America back in the day. Spider-Man, Kraven's Last Hunt in particular, classic stories, unbelievable work that he's done for decades, and great stuff on the Spectre, and when Hal Jordan became the Spectre for a while, and really interesting stories. Moonshadow, him and John Muth back in the 80s, Brooklyn Dreams, so many great books, and really a great creator who hit the black and white era and the direct market era of the 80s and really stretched out beyond the traditional superhero stories. And that work continues. Savior 28, what a great story that he did for IDW back in the day. And, you know, the current list, it continues in that tradition. We're going to talk about some of his newest projects. For instance, Impossible Inc., a very fun all-ages story. But as Mark likes to say, it's not just all ages, and sometimes that's a turnoff to people. But it really is. It's a great escapist fantasy adventure from IDW. Of course, he's been doing incredible work in animation for years. Great stuff. Like, you know, he adapted the wonderful Alan Moore, Dave Gibbons Superman story for The Man Who Has Everything for Justice League Unlimited. He took an original Steranko story about Mr. Miracle and Fourth World characters in Justice League and wrote the script for that. He also has done Constantine, City of Demons, the movie, the great animated movie that's available now. It's on DC Universe. It's available for a DVD purchase and also, of course, you know, any digital streaming purchases as well. But, I mean, we just saw it a couple weeks ago on the CW, a great hour-long special about John Constantine showing a good portion of the movie, intercutting with great stuff about Constantine's participation in Legends of Tomorrow. Man, I got to tell you, as an older reader, when this stuff happens on primetime TV on a major network and they decide to spend an hour talking about a comic book character, I got to tell you, man, it's a brave new world, and I'm glad that I'm around to see it, and I love it. I just think it's incredible, and we talk about that because I know Mark shares that same amazement of what the hell's going on, but it was fantastic. So we talk about that. He's got some really cool stuff coming up as well. I mentioned Moonshadow, his wonderful 80s work with John Muth, this amazing story, seriously, that you really could put alongside the best of Neil Gaiman's Sandman, the best Alan Moore fantasy stuff. He and John Muth, such a great version of it's their story, Moonshadow, that they did for Epic, Marvel's premier line back in the 80s. Well, now the definitive Moonshadow edition is coming out in 2019. Also, he's working with Karen Berger for Dark Horse's imprint, Berger Books. We talk about The Girl in the Bay. That is another darker kind of Vertigo kind of thing. You got to remember, man, Mark is not only a great superhero writer, but like I said, I mean, the Constantine stuff right there along with the best of Vertigo and a lot of his stuff that Karen edited over the years. Well, they're working together again. Girl in the Bay, he gives us a description. This is another cool thing that's coming in February from Berger Books. So all those things and more in a great conversation with Mark DeMatteis on today's Word Balloon. It's all brought to you by the League of Word Balloon listeners. Thank you very much, League, for your support. I'm posting this at the end of November. Thank you very much for your support via Patreon. It means a lot. You know, I'm doing what I can to keep the lights on here at wordballoon.com, and everything's going fine. Don't worry, I'm not in dire straits, but really, your support and subscriptions for the Word Balloon are really helping keeping things moving forward, keeping me going to put out some amazing podcasts, and it's on your backs, and I truly appreciate that. You are all executive producers of Word Balloon with your contributions to Patreon. Thank you. Word Balloon is free. It will always be free because I want more people to jump on the Word Balloon bandwagon and enjoy what I'm trying to do here and provide interesting conversations in the pop culture world. If you can, I know it's the holidays. I know that our money is going into gifts and other things. And hey, man, everyone's struggling. Believe me, I get it. But if you can afford subscribing to Word Balloon, is Word Balloon worth a dollar a month? Is it worth the price of a comic book a month? I think I provide some interesting conversations that only enhance your interest in the subjects we cover here at wordballoon.com. If you're interested, if you can subscribe to Word Balloon, go to patreon.com/wordballoon or click on the ad on the front page of wordballoon.com. Thank you, League of Word Balloon listeners. This Word Balloon episode is also sponsored by Aftershock Comics, who are shaking things up at your local comic shop right now. Amazing hit series, Lollipop Kids from Adam and Aiden Glass and Diego Yapur, A Walk Through Hell from Garth Ennis and Gordon Suzuka. Is that not enough Garth Ennis for you? What about Jimmy's Bastards, another great series from Garth Ennis and Russ Brown? There's Pestilence from Frank Thierry, coming out with a new trade in early January. This is Christmas season. You can get a lot of great books from Aftershock. And the great thing is, these are all names that you recognize. They write your favorite books. Well, they're doing amazing original titles at Aftershock Comics. Cullen Bunn and Dalibor Taljic are doing Witchhammer. This is Aftershock's first original graphic novel. It's coming out in just a couple weeks, December 19th. We're going to be talking to Cullen in the days ahead, so be looking for that. But really, it's Christmas time, and I'll remind you as well in the middle commercial that Aftershock is a perfect option to buy a new comic book for your favorite comic book reader or even yourself and treat yourself to a new book, and you can jump right in. There are trades available now. There are first issues available. And I really think it's a great option for you, for your favorite comic book reader at Christmas time, to give them the gift of Aftershock Comics. Check out full story descriptions, preview pages, and the diamond codes on these books to order through your local comic shop at AftershockComics.com. All right, without further ado, let's get into our conversation now with Mark DeMatteis, talking about all of his new projects and more right now on Word Balloon. J.M. DeMatteis, I like to call him Mark because he lets me. Welcome back to Word Balloon. Always a pleasure, man. Thanks for coming back.
Happy to be here, John.
Sad news last week with Stan Lee's passing, and figured that maybe, you know, if we start, I don't know if you have any fun Stan Lee memories or stories.
You know, I'm still processing. It's, you know, yeah. I was saying to somebody, Stan meant a lot to all of us, and yet we all knew he was fading. And yet when the news came through that he had died, I was almost shocked by how profoundly moved I was and how profoundly sad I was. You know, it really is like losing a member of the family, you know, because he is sort of the grandfather to all of us in this business in a lot of ways, you know, and it's just very, very sad. And I've, if anyone wants to go to my website, I have like three different Stan posts. In fact, I just put one up today because I've been reading all these obituaries for the past week, some of which are so like completely ignorant of the reality of Marvel and the reality of how comic books are produced. You know, it's really kind of astonishing. So I just wanted to get a few more thoughts out of my head, and I wrote them up today and put them on my website. But yeah, it's just a profoundly sad thing. I didn't have a lot of I have a lot of friends in the business who knew Stan really well and spent mm-hmm. a lot of time with him. I didn't, you know. I was saying somewhere probably the first time I bumped into him was when I just started at Marvel, and he was occasionally still in the office. And I just remember being at the copy machine making a copy of some Conan artwork, and like Stan appeared ready to make copies. And it was all I could do not to bow to him as I backed away. You know
what I mean? Sure.
And then I don't know if I've ever told this story, but I had this gig, and this is about Stan, but not, because Shooter, before I was under contract at Marvel, would throw me these little gigs. Okay. And they were suing some company. I don't remember, there was a cartoon called Web Woman.
Go on. Crazy.
And so Marvel was suing Web Woman over Spider-Man.
Sure.
So Shooter hired me, and this was my gig, honest to God. Stan was in California. He put me in Stan's office for like, I don't know, a week or two with Stan's VCR and TV, where I watched cartoons and wrote up little documents about the similarities between Web Woman and Spider-Man. So imagine, I'm just starting out in the business, and I'm like, I get to hang out in Stan's office for like 2 weeks watching cartoons. And I got paid for it. That's unbelievable?
It's a loss. And like you said, I mean, it's something that we're still processing. And yeah, I'm surprised too. I was going to release a new interview with Brian Bendis last Monday, and we both knowing that Stan had passed, we're like, yeah, let's hold off and let's give Stan some memorial time. And so, and fortuitously for me, I was already prepared to be talking with Fred Van Lente about a couple of his new projects. But, you know, he did that comic book history of comics. And, you know, de facto historian, and certainly spent a lot of time examining Stan's entire career, his contributions. And I'm like, oh, this is a good guy to kind of have an extemporaneous conversation with about Stan's passing. So that became kind of my memorial episode. But, yeah, I'm surprised. Like I said, I released the Bendis tapes as we're recording this today. And there was still even a little part of me going, all right, you know, I'm still kind of bummed about Stan. I don't know. But it's also like, all right, you know, like, we can move on and still remember him. And that's why I'm happy to talk to people like you that have had your encounters with Stan and, you know, are, yeah, I mean, just part of the pastiche of memories. And I envy all of you that spent time working with him on stuff and around him, as you say, with the Web Woman thing. And I'll also appreciate your perspective too on, the Kirby and Ditko stuff, because yeah, you're right. It's a complicated story. And truly, yes, minimize Stan's contributions is a complete disservice. And just shows, as you say, uninformed bloggers out there who just didn't know what they were writing.
Oh, not just bloggers, you know, like from, you know, major entertainment magazines, major newspapers. They, you know, it's like anything else with any other discipline. People don't understand it unless you're behind the scenes. You know, whenever I read articles about things that I know a lot about, you realize how much ignorance is the wrong word, but how much bad information is coming through to us every day.
Well,
because I know about something, I go, oh, no, that's not really right. You know?
Well, there's no gatekeepers anymore, man. I mean, that's the thing. I don't know what editors do these days and if they have the factual background to really check these things out. And it's like, yeah, no, that's not right. And yeah, like you say, a lot of that just gets out. Well, and, you know, as I'm sure you read, too, there were probably people out there, the creator of Wolverine, no. Creator of Deadpool,
right.
No.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, the extremes from, like, giving credit to Stan for everything, probably they credit him for creating Superman. Who knows, you know? To the other extreme where it's like, he didn't do anything. He was just a bum, and he just did that. Kirby wrote everything in the borders, and Stan just copied it, which is complete bullshit. You know, like I said, it was a combination of really great talents, and Marvel would not have happened if you removed any of those pieces from the puzzle. It would have never happened.
Totally. And again, the man carried water during the rough times of Marvel as well, and still was out there promoting. And he's a fascinating person. And yeah, it's a smaller pop culture world without him. It definitely is.
You know, we can move on, but I just want to say one more thing. I've always had this image in my head when I want to explain what I think, and I wasn't there either, but based on everything I know, what I think the Lee Kirby collaboration was like. And I always have this image of, like, it's 1962, Stan and Jack are walking down the street, and they're walking past an empty lot. Stan keeps walking, Jack stops, and he's staring at this empty lot and says, "Wait, I'll be right back." Stan goes, "Where are you going?" Jack runs back, he's got, like, wood and hammers and nails, and then he runs into this lot, clears it out, and builds this amazing house, right? And Stan's like, "Oh my God, that's an incredible house you just built." And then, you know, Kirby's done. He wanders off and Stan goes, "Wait a minute." And Stan goes in and he puts down some seed and some flowers and he puts in a brick walk and he paints the house in amazing colors. And he goes inside and he paints and puts in furniture and hangs things on the wall. And then he goes on the roof and starts ringing a bell saying, "Everybody come see the greatest house that's ever been made." And people come and he comes to the front door and he invites them in and he gives them tours, you know. So Jack could have built a house like that on his own, but Stan added so much to the house and then was able to bring people into the house and tell them how great it was. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
And by the time Stan's up there ringing the bell, Jack's already in the next lot building another house. He's not even thinking about it. You know?
That's a good analogy. Absolutely, man.
It's the combination of those two skills, you know. It's amazing, really amazing.
No question. I was pouring through – I was just telling you about some of the YouTube rabbit holes I've been going down. And when Stan passed away, I went back and found that black and white 1968 Stan Lee show that he made where he
I tweeted that out a few weeks ago. I had never seen it before.
Yeah, neither had I. The counterculture journalist that he was talking to, like on a panel show. Very, very interesting. And then his game show appearance on To Tell the Truth.
Right. I've seen that too.
Well, the one I couldn't find was him on Mike Douglas with George Carlin and Joan Rivers. And I remember this vividly as a little kid.
I don't,
Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I never saw that one.
They had a – they almost at the end of the show, they had a superhero fashion show. And Joan was dressed as Wonder Woman, but she wore a cape. So she didn't have to, like, show up in the, you know, onesie or whatever.
Right.
And George Carlin was dressed as Spider-Man. And in typical Carlin fashion, he points to himself and goes, "The spider." And then he points to his crotch and goes, "And the fly." You know. And Stan was dressed as Captain America, and he didn't wear the mask, but he wore the costume. And he looked great. And I think Mike Douglas was dressed as Superman at the end, and he came out last. But, yeah, they, you know, typical Mike Douglas kind of panel back and forth and everything. But, yeah, those were the three people. It was really interesting, and I was hoping to find it. Couldn't find it.
Wait, let us pause while most of your listeners go, who's Who? Mike Douglas?
No kidding. I know. Again, mostly this, yeah, this is a conversation to indulge Mark and myself. You guys just happen to be along for the ride. But that's okay. Because we're going to talk about new stuff as well. Hey, yeah. Before we get to your Create Your Own stuff, yeah. I am so excited for you with this association with the Constantine cartoon. And also, not only, you know, in typical Warner Animation fashion that it goes out direct to video, it's a great story, but to get a nice showcase on the CW that was half, hey, Legends of Tomorrow are coming, you know, next week. But in the meantime, enjoy this Constantine cartoon.
I know. I was kind of—I didn't even know about it in advance until I saw some ad for it somewhere, and I was like, "Holy Moses!" It's interesting because this—the Constantine—it's called Constantine: City of Demons, mm-hmm. and the way it was done was really interesting because, like, obviously they're playing with new media. I wrote it as a full-length film, and what they did then is they broke it up into these little five-minute episodes, which they put the first five, I think, on CW Seed. Last March, I went out to WonderCon. We had a big premiere. Matt Ryan was there. It was really a lot of fun.
Cool.
They released those. And then we were just at New York Comic Con for the release of the full-length movie. So they put out the whole movie, which has material that you'll never see on CWC. I have to plug it that way so people sure. will buy it. You can also stream it. You don't have to buy a DVD. You can stream it on Amazon and Google Play and all that. And now, and then they will eventually show the rest of the episodes on CW Seed, I guess maybe early next year or something. So it's being released in all these different formats, and I had no clue it was going to be on prime time, you know. So that was really interesting. It's been out in many, many different forms and shapes. But I have to say, it's one of the best anime. I've done a lot of animation in the past 15 years,
yes.
tons of it, and this was one of the best projects I've ever been involved with. You know, sometimes you work on a project. And the creative part of it is really great, and it's really, really fun. And then the project comes out, and you go, oh, it really didn't work. It was fun to work on, but it didn't work out the way I wanted. And sometimes working on it is hell, and the result is you have a great project. This was one of those rare projects where working on it was just a delight from day one, and then it turned out to be just a really, really great film. I'm really, really proud of the directing, the acting, every level. It's just really, really really superb. And if you're a Constantine fan, and if you're a fan of Constantine from the comics especially, this is as close to the Hellblazer that we know from Vertigo as you're going to see on screen anywhere. Just a delightful project for me from beginning to end.
I understand. And again, you're 100% right. It nails the Constantine idea and the Hellblazer form of Constantine. And yeah, I think it's great. Matt Ryan is such a perfect actor, and it is so wonderful that he has had the time and willingness to maintain this relationship with the character. And, you know, that as soon as it was on NBC, I think a lot of us are like, okay, let's hopefully get through at least a season, maybe two.
Right.
And
right.
so to only get 13 episodes, it was really disappointing. But then for him to, you know, do Justice League Dark, to do City of Demons, and then true to be part of Legends of Tomorrow,
yeah.
and always be the Matt Ryan Constantine. That's great. When you were writing it, as you say, it is. It's very Hellblazer and stuff. But I'm sure you've, like, seen enough Matt Ryan Constantine to, like, how much of it was writing for his voice as well?
Yeah, I have to, you know, usually I create the character's voices, my own version in my head. But he is so identified with that character that in the writing, it has to be him. I remember I was working on the Justice League Dark comic book when the mm-hmm. first ads came out for the Constantine TV series. And it just looked like the character come to life. I'd look inside the comic and look at a drawing of Constantine and flip to the back cover, and it was the same guy. It's some of the best comics to screen casting ever, I think.
Agreed.
And he so perfectly embodies that character. And I was really glad I had a chance to meet him at WonderCon. Really nice guy, really down to earth, not full of that Hollywood ego bloat. You know?
Understood.
Yeah, just a really nice guy, and he seems to really appreciate what's come his way with this character, because it's the kind of thing, you know, it used to be when you were identified with one character like that, if God forbid you were identified with Captain Kirk or Mr. Spock, you had to fight your way out of that paper bag.
Absolutely.
In order to break that. Right. But these days, you know, that kind of pop culture fame is a very different animal, and it opens the door on lots of other things for actors. So he basically said he'd be very happy to be identified with Constantine for the rest of his life. He's just fine with it, and he should be fine with it because he just does a brilliant job. So
as an aside, I wonder, you know, and don't get me wrong, the Birdman movie with Michael Keaton was, mm-hmm. from a technical standpoint, so amazing, and it's an interesting story. But I hate to admit it, but the one thing that was in the back of my head was they set up that, well, he's typecast and he can never do anything else. And I'm like, that's an 80s and 90s right. problem and earlier. I'm like, that doesn't exist
that's
anymore.
True.
Downey has proved that. Chris Nolan has proved – or Chris the Batman of the Chris Nolan movies.
Oh, Batman of the Chris Nolan movies. Now we're both going to blank.
Yeah, exactly. Shame on us again.
I can see his face, and now I can't think of his name.
Well, and that's because we know him in The Mechanic, and we know him in The Fighter, right. and all these other movies that he continues to do, right. and the Terminator movie. Yeah, it's not a problem anymore. And that was really – every time they would be like, oh, you know, he's been Birdman for so long, he can't do anything else, and this is such a gamble. And I'm like, yeah, we must be in the 90s because that's not a problem anymore.
Right. Christian Bale.
Christian Bale, attaboy. Well done. You win. What do we have for him, Johnny?
I win this game show because I used Google while we were talking.
That's all right. You did good. That's
no, I can't man, lie. I can't lie.
So that's great. So the City of Demons movie is complete and available now. And as you say, has a lot of other scenes that weren't in the chapters or certainly not on the TV presentation.
And won't be in the chapters that come out either. There's an extra, I think, 20 minutes in the full-length movie that's not on the CW seed.
Interesting. But it is available now.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Okay, cool. That's cool. Well, you know, and honestly, and I don't expect you to – you might have an answer to this, but I don't know. The CW seed and DC Universe, I'm like, oh, well, then maybe they're going to ditch the CW seed or fold in everything that was at the seed onto DC Universe. And it's like, no, those are two separate apps still, and one
is
free.
Yeah, they are. I'm actually – and I can't say what it is, but I'm working on another DC-related animated thing for CW seed right now. So
interesting.
And that's where it's going to be. It's going to be the same thing as Constantine with the episodes and then the full-length movie. And I think they think there are two different audiences for that, because I think they know the hardcore, like a hardcore Constantine fan is going to want the movie. And then there maybe is a more casual watcher who would want to watch it on CW seed but not spring for the movie. So I think maybe they think they're working two different audiences there.
I understand. And you're right. And there is that kind of schism between television superhero fans and hardcore comic book fans.
Yeah.
And it's certainly funny, and I know you see it as well when you go to the conventions, and the two streams of fandom that are now coming
I think
through.
That's one of the reasons why conventions have so exploded in recent years, is that there's a whole other mass of fans that know these characters from TV, from movies, from video games, and will never in a million years pick up a comic book. It's kind of sad, but they are enthusiastic fans of these characters, and they're not comic book fans. The other thing I was astonished to discover, because I knew Constantine was popular, but doing the promo for City of Demons, there's a huge Constantine audience out there. And I think a lot of them as well know him from the TV series, and maybe hopefully they'll wheel back and go read some comic books along the way. But it's amazing. It's like a separate audience. And I'm discovering over the years from doing animation that there's hardcore animation fans that love and follow all these DC animated things, but maybe don't read all the comics. So it's one of the things that really like makes my head explode. I don't understand why, with the huge popularity of these movies, it doesn't feed back into the comics more. I think the only time that ever happened was with the first Tim Burton Batman movie, which I think really had an impact on the Batman sales for a year or two there.
I understand. But would you say when you were younger, though, Please finish your thought, and then I'll ask the question.
Well, that was basically the end of it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask because I go through this as well in my mind and in conversation with others as well. But then I have to remember it's like, and someone even asked me and said, "What was your first exposure to comics?" And I'm like, "Well, you know, I was born in '64, and even before I was able to read comic books, and I mean, I remember 12-cent and 15-cent comics as at a very early age. But that said, George Reeves Superman." The Ralph Bashke Spider-Man TV cartoon.
Right.
Certainly Adam West and Batman. I'm like, so those things were there. They were in my mind at a very early age and led me to the comics. So, you know, I don't know. And it's funny because I'll ask other generations, and there are certainly those that grew up with the Batman animated series. Right. And I love the fact that people like Devin Grayson, one of the best writers out there, that was her entry point. And certainly became a great comic book writer. So your age and stuff, yeah. Well, I mean, was you know George Reeves Superman? What were the things that were on television?
Yeah,
or,
I mean,
or whatever.
When I was, you know, I've got about 10 years on you. So you know, the George Reeves Superman was on television.
Sure.
But you know, here's the thing with me though, I couldn't tell you when I started reading comics because I don't remember not reading comics.
Okay.
It's a weird thing. I don't know who first gave them to me, but as far back as my mind will stretch, I remember having comics. And I know, you know, I would go take a walk with my father in the evening when he'd go buy the evening paper, something that people don't do anymore.
Sure.
And he'd buy me a comic book. What, he was springing for 10 to 12 cents? What's the big deal, you know?
Yep.
So they were just always there. So TV didn't drive me to comics. And really, what was there to see when I was a kid except for the George Reeves Superman show?
Okay.
I remember coming home from school, like in the first grade, I think it was, and or maybe even younger, my mother saying, "Why she told me, I don't know. Look in the newspaper. Superman killed himself."
Wow. Yeah. Holy cow.
I look back and I go, wait a minute. Why did you tell me that?
And Santa Claus hung himself in the bathroom.
That's right. And the Easter Bunny's got his foot caught in a trap. He had to chew it off. Yeah.
What about?
So, you know, the big thing for me was when I was in junior high was the Batman TV show. That was like huge because the Superman TV show didn't look like a comic book. It really, you know, it didn't have all those other elements and it was in black and white. So it was, you know, you had one guy in a costume and a bunch of thugs with guns, you know, that he could, yep. you know, bonk their heads together.
Exactly.
You know, occasionally they do something, you know, bigger and cooler, but mostly it was him bonking guys' heads together, you know?
Oh, totally.
As much as I loved that show and thought George Reeves was great.
Oh, he was amazing. And you know, there's a huge difference too, in that first season with Phyllis Coates,
yes.
and then it became more of a kid's show. Because I always say, and my comparison is the 70s Shazam Captain Marvel show, and how benign the action was on that show. I'm like, my God, that makes the first season of Superman look like Pulp Fiction.
Oh, yeah, well, the first season, the villains were throwing old ladies in wheelchairs downstairs. Yes. I mean, it was kind of like Superman film noir. And then you're right, because a few years back when my daughter was a little younger, we watched a whole bunch of them. So we started and we watched them chronologically. And by the time you get to like season three, it's like, what happened?
Yeah, yeah. It gets really children level entertainment. And
but,
that's,
you know,
fine.
But Batman was, to me, in the seventh grade, it was like, that looks like a comic book. Lots of people in costumes. And I didn't even have a color TV yet at that age, but it didn't matter. It just, you know, I remember just seeing the commercials before it came on. And oh, my God, it's Batman and the Riddler. And it looks like a comic. I could not wait. And it took me quite a while to admit to myself that maybe the show wasn't meant to be taken seriously, you know.
Yeah, well,
I was so hardcore, I couldn't admit it, you know?
It was I always say it's like the three stages of Batman. When you're a little kid, it is high drama and high action. And then you get that adolescent period where you're like, oh, this is too corny, and yeah, maybe, you know, it's not as good as I thought it was. And then around college or high school, it hits you, oh, they're purposely being funny. And then you're like, my God, this is a great comedy.
Right,
and you realize the genius of the deadpan, you know, acting of Adam West and just the lunacy of it. And yeah, now it's, you know, amazing again. And yeah, I truly, luckily, unlike Stan Lee, I never got a chance to really sit down and have any time with Stan. I did get a chance a couple times to talk to Adam West.
Oh, that's great.
And yeah, he was incredible. And we were talking about people like Lorenzo Semple, who wrote so many of the episodes and wrote the movie. Yeah, it was just a great formula. And I'm glad that it now gets its due, because I felt that was another thing that fandom, you know, was just a little too harsh about. And it's like, yeah, it's supposed to be ridiculous. You know, well, it's ridiculous. I don't like it. It's like, well, it's supposed to be ridiculous. It's okay.
It's another one of those things that over time people have embraced.
Yeah.
For a while, it was not cool, and then people embraced it. I think also there was that sort of damage that it did, that for 40 years afterwards, every article about comic books had to start Zap Pal Bam. Yeah.
Yes.
Didn't matter if it was about mouse. You
That's
know, it was
oh like, my God, you're right.
Zoom, Will Eisner is a contract with God, you know? And it's like,
100%, man. Okay, let's take a break from the conversation and tell you a little bit more about our friends at Aftershock Comics. Now, again, it's the Christmas season, and sometimes you do. You rack your brains. What are you going to get for your favorite person that they don't already get? Because sometimes you do. You pick up that Superman trade, that X-Men trade, and it's like, yeah, I already got it. Thanks. So, you know, you don't want to mess up. But the great thing is at Aftershock Comics, you will find tons of genres that you love by your favorite writers and artists, and they're doing great original stories that might have slipped through the cracks. They shouldn't, though, because I'm telling you, Mike Martz and Joe Pruitt, the two creative minds behind Aftershock Comics, are out there talking to their friends in comics and saying, hey, come on over to Aftershock. If you got a story, let's hear about it. Maybe we'll want to print it. And you get things like the spy series, Jimmy's Bastards, from Garth Ennis and Russ Braun, Pestilence from Frank Thierry, and Oleg Akunov, where the 14th century Black Plague from history is actually revealed as the first zombie outbreak. You can get the first trade now. Give that as a Christmas gift. And the great thing is the second trade is coming out in early January. So, you know, if they like the first volume of Pestilence, they're going to get volume two in early January. There's Baby Teeth, Year One, the hardcover from Donnie Cates and Gary Brown, the first 10 issues of the series. That is coming out December 5th. Or the brand new first original graphic novel from Aftershock, Witchhammer. It's great. Cullen Bunn, Dalibor Talajic. It's in stores December 19th. These creators came to Aftershock to tell their kind of stories with no rules, no forced continuity, just a new platform to tell fresh, great concepts. Now, in the weeks ahead and days ahead, we'll be talking to more Aftershock creators about their books. I mean, I'm talking about people like Steve Orlando. We're going to talk to Frank Thierry. Eventually, we're going to be talking to Marguerite Bennett about Animosity and so many more, man. I got to tell you, I'm really happy because in a lot of cases, these are the first times I get to talk to some of these creators. And my old friends as well that are working at Aftershock. Paul Jenkins is over there. My dear friend Phil Hester. Truly, I mean, these are great people that over the years I've forged these nice associations and, you know, I would say friendships. And it's only meant for deeper conversation here at Word Balloon. And it's terrific that not only am I working with Aftershock in terms of sponsorship, they're working with Aftershock. So it's a win-win for us and a win for you and maybe somebody as well on your Christmas list. Do yourself a favor. Go to AftershocksComics.com. You will find full story descriptions, preview pages, and also the diamond codes on their books to order through your local comic shop. It's all waiting for you at AftershockComics.com. All right, let's get back into our conversation now with Mark DeMatteis on Word Balloon.
But that's why it's so amazing now. We're living in this golden age of superhero media where wherever you look, you know, you can literally turn on the TV virtually any night of the week and there's a superhero show on. Every other week, there's a new movie that comes out, not to mention the animated shows and the video games. It's, you know, if I could go back in time and tell my little 12-year-old self what's going on now, he would pass out from excitement.
100%.
It's really incredible to the point where I think now I'm getting a little numb to it. It takes a really great superhero movie now to get me really, really, really excited.
I understand. I have liked the Marvel movies, certainly. I think DC is still finding its footing in the movie world, with the exceptions of Wonder Woman. We'll see what Aquaman is like in a couple weeks. But I do, you know, and even from a television standpoint, I agree with you. I don't know if I worry about oversaturation or not, but I do understand what you're saying. I'm certainly excited about the Elseworlds crossover that's coming for the CW shows, because those are always incredibly fun. I thought last year's was great, you know, with EarthX and everything. So, yeah, I'm excited. And again, I think the shows still intrigue me, I especially Arrow right now. I think Arrow is really kicking ass right now.
The CW shows have been great. I mean, all the stuff is very, very well done. For me as an audience member, maybe it's because I spend so much of my time with these characters anyway, I don't think the audience out there is saturated. I feel a little oversaturated. So it takes a little bit more. Like I watch these movies and I'll go, well, that was really fun. And then I forget about it and it doesn't really have a lasting impact. And I realize if you just isolate one of these movies and go back in time 10 years ago and imagine watching it 10 years ago, your jaw would be on the floor. But because we see them so often, I think I'm just a little bit like, okay, now we're in the third act and there's a lot of explosions. I get it. And yeah, clever clips, I get it. Not that I don't appreciate them, but I just think there's so much of that for me as an audience member, I'm just a little more numb to it. So it takes a little more for me to go, wow, that was really good. And that's was it last year the Wolverine movie came out?
Yes, Logan. Well, it was, or maybe it was 16.
Maybe it was. But like that was one of them where I went, That wasn't a good superhero movie. That was just a really good movie.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
And so I wait for those, the ones that like take me to that next step now of like, that was, you know, I need that extra oomph.
And I hear you, man.
I enjoy them all and I see them all and I enjoy them all. But to get that kind of thrill that you got with, say, the first Christopher Reeve Superman movie or the early Spider-Man movies or X-Men movies or even the first Captain America movie, which I totally adore.
Yeah.
And it's only because there's just so much of it. Like, it's just like special effects, you know. Terminator 2, the special effects were absolutely blew our minds, or The Matrix when we saw it for the first time. And now you watch a commercial that has the same high level of special effects
that
the movies did. So we're not like wowed by it in the same way. So it takes more, I think, to wow us, or at least wow me as an audience. And that more has to always be about the character. And that's why I like that Wolverine movie so much. I'm not even a big Wolverine fan. Never particularly cared for that character. I loved that movie. I thought it was really, really good.
No, I completely agree with you about Logan. It's an exceptional movie. And I keep making the comparison to the superhero genre films to the Westerns, because we got a shit ton of Westerns from the silent era all the way, you know, certainly through modern day. It had a little lull in the 80s, but they were still there. And as much as they would grind them out, every now and then, you know, you would get a Stagecoach, you'd get High Noon, you'd get those Bud Bedeker movies, and they were the ones that would stand out. And I think with Logan, also from a you know, fun, raunchy comedy standpoint with the Deadpool movies, those are the films that are really stretching the medium. Or then you get a big blockbuster. I mean, Infinity – I wanted to know as a Marvel writer what your thoughts were about Infinity War specifically.
Oh, I enjoyed it. I have to say, and I have to frame it in what I was saying before.
Yeah,
I wasn't bowled over by it or anything,
okay,
but I thoroughly enjoyed it. In fact, I think I enjoyed it out of the three Avengers movies. It's the one I enjoyed the most. It was an enjoyable movie. What else? I don't know what else to say. It did not impact me the way, say, the Wolverine movie did.
Okay, because to me that was the one that felt the most like a Marvel event comic book, because all the franchises were right on top of each other.
Right.
And it literally did to me feel like, hey, the Guardians movie just invaded the Avengers movie.
Right.
And suddenly has taken a different point of view with Iron Man trying to figure out these numbskulls.
Well,
and
it was
great.
As you say that, and I realize that this, what I'm saying, and this is not a knock on that movie, it was an incredibly well done movie and it deserved its success. So I'm not knocking it in any way, shape, or form. But I realize, just as a writer, I prefer a narrower focus on character. You know, if you look at, say, Kraven's Last Hunt, it's essentially about three characters, you know, Spider-Man, Kraven, and Vermin, with a little bit of Mary Jane on the side, and that's it. And it goes on for six issues.
Yeah.
I like to dive deep. The Wolverine movie was more focused. You know, it was not a big epic. It was really character driven.
100%.
And that's just my nature as a writer, and as an audience, I prefer that. After a certain point, the epic and the spectacle becomes white noise to me.
I can appreciate that, man.
But
absolutely.
That's just me. Yeah, you know what I mean? So please don't anyone write me letters and I'm not knocking the movies at all. I think the Marvel movies have been phenomenal and I really enjoy them. I'm just saying that for me, I need to take it to another level for me to like really, really be knocked out by these things now. And it's mainly because they've done such a good job so consistently for so long that we almost take it for granted, if you know what I mean.
I understand, man. And again, that your stories are so narrowly character focused. Going Sane, the Joker story that you told.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and another, I always like to point out my favorite DeMatteis story is your Captain America run, where it ends with, you know, the Skull and Captain America literally like fighting hand to hand. And that great, I hate the word penultimate, but it fits in this case, the second to last chapter when the Skull puts Cap in a virtual reality machine and he gets to save Bucky.
Right.
And it has that that great cover. Was that Zek?
It's been a while.
I know. Sorry, buddy. I know. I don't mean to keep like, you know. No, damn it. Remember this thing from 1975 right now. It was the recreation of that classic moment of Cap and Bucky hanging off the drone. And you know what's going to happen. And also just on the interiors, this shocked look on Bucky's face and this like elation on Steve's face. Like, I saved you. I always knew I could save you. And then all of a sudden the virtual reality ends. And it's the Skull, and he's like, okay, good. I've put your mind to ease. Now let's fight. And it's like, wow, oh, my God, look what's coming. Holy shit.
But there was a story that was really, you know, there were obviously other characters involved, but it was so focused on the two of them. And that's just my preference as a writer. And not that I haven't written big epic things over the years and lots of team books, but that's more my wheelhouse as a writer and as an audience, which is why – I guess, you know, I don't need every movie to tie into every other movie. Do you know what I mean?
I don't need
cameos by the other characters. If I'm going to go see a Spider-Man movie or an Iron Man movie or whoever it is, tell me a story about that character. I don't need the rest of the Marvel Universe to show up. But I also know that for 90% of the audience, that's what they want. And they do it really well. You know, they do it really well. So why not?
Well, there's room for both. I mean, and again, that's what's exciting right now about the genre is we're just at the beginning of them really experimenting with the genre. And, you know, Ant-Man being the comedy that it was compared to, you know, the other movies and stuff. No, I think there's room to grow. And that's why I'm not worried about saturation from that standpoint. And it's like I said, I keep making the Western comparison. So I think we're okay. But moving on to other current projects and the like, let's talk about your creator-owned book that you're doing. Again, I'm happy to see you and Mike Cavallaro teaming up again. Your Savior 28 story is one of my recent DeMatteis favorites, and I'm glad you guys are back together again on this new story. So you're midway through it. Tell us about the book.
Yeah, you know, Mike he's one of my favorite collaborators. We did Savior 28 together. We've done several other things together. Most recently, we did a story for the Where We Live anthology that was raising the victims of the last Las Vegas shooting. And, and it was really a sad project, but one I was very proud to be part of. And just Mike is one of those guys. He pencils, he inks, he colors, he letters, he does everything, you know, and he does it really well. And then he has the audacity to be a really nice guy on top of that. It's just incredible.
100%.
So, you know, this is a project we've been talking about, God, must be going back at least to 2010 or so.
Okay.
And it started with a conversation about Silver Age comics. Those sort of wonderful Superman, Batman stories that on one level were like so ridiculous, but on another level were so filled with imagination and so kid friendly. And so, well, how do we take that sort of concept and rework it and do it now with a contemporary spin? Meaning, that level of imagination and fun. And also, you know, we're both big Kirby fans. So you see a lot of Kirby, a lot of sort of Fantastic Four / Kirby influence in this thing. But just sort of recast it and make it our own and have fun with it so that hopefully anyone can pick it up. You know, you could give it to your 10-year-old niece or you could give it to your 70-year-old uncle and everyone will enjoy it. And so we cooked up this big cosmic adventure. One writer friend of mine said it reminded him of sort of a combination of the best elements of Doctor Who and Doc Savage and the Fantastic Four. I'll take that. That sounds like a great description.
Absolutely. Wow.
I hope it's half that good, you know. But it is. It's our main character is a 17-year-old, a genius named Number Horowitz, and her father was this sort of Doc Savage, Reed Richards figure. But he disappeared when she was 7 years old, and she's had to take over the family business, which is called Impossible Incorporated, and they have this this train called the Non-Local Express that travels across dimensions and explores what we call the infinite spiral, which is basically all of creation. And so it's on the one hand, it's a big sort of Kirby-esque, Doctor Who-ish adventure across time and space, but it's also her search for her father and her own personal issues as she's still dealing years later with the loss of a father and her mother who died when she was even younger. So it's a personal story and a cosmic story. And we're just having a great time with it. And as you know, these independent creator-owned books, it's hard to find a footing in the marketplace when you've got so much other stuff coming out just from Marvel and DC, let alone from all the other companies. So I appreciate the chance to be here and just let people know about it, because I'm sure there are lots of people that know and like my work and have no clue this book is even out there. So the third issue comes out next week, November 28th.
Cool.
I'm sure you can still get the first two, and it's a 5-issue mini, and if it goes well, we can play with these characters forever, because we literally have the entire multiverse to play with in this series.
That's excellent, man. And no, I know that you have, in particular, in the last few years, as well as adult stories, you have been doing a lot of all-ages stories as well. And I'm glad that IDW is backing you up with this. And the one you did, and forgive me, the Greek artist that you worked with.
Vasilis, Godzilis.
Yes, yeah, indeed.
The Adventures of Augusta Wind.
Yes.
Which there's
and, of course, Abadazad.
Yeah, there's 2 volumes of Augusta Wind out there. Stardust Kid that I did with Mike Plug is Boom just put out a new edition last year.
Fantastic.
And, yeah, and of course, Abadazad, which I can't talk about without getting emotionally stressed.
All right, I understand. Tom Waters, I can appreciate that. Yeah, I understand. And hey, no, I'm so Impossible League. No, it sounds great. Tell us about some of the other creators characters that are in Impossible League.
So we have her father that she's searching for. She has her stepbrother who was an orphan that her father adopted from India. She has her aunt who is basically a techno psychic, meaning she's psychic, but it's because she's had psychic implants put into her head.
Hilarious.
And then her father's partner in the business, whose name is Elias Walter, who is sort of the old uncle figure. So it's these four, the four of them traveling across time and space, having a great time. And Elias Walter, he was named for Walt Disney because Walt Disney's name is Walter Elias Disney. So I just flipped it around.
Hilarious. I didn't even catch that. That's great.
I just would encourage anyone that, and I also want to say something too. You know, I always hesitate to label these things as all ages because I know there's a certain part of the audience that goes, "Oh, it's all ages. It's not for me. It's not cool enough." It's just a good, solid story that I hope anyone can enjoy. But it's nice to have something that anyone can enjoy and that I can turn around and give to my 7-year-old nephew, you know, and say, "Here, I can give this to you without worrying." You know,
I understand.
The other thing we tried to do with this story, too, was have a really great adventure story that doesn't depend on violent confrontation, where there's lots of great concepts and lots of exciting things happening, but it's not about two guys dropping buildings on each other's heads. And that was really important to us. And I think I haven't written the 5th issue yet, but I think we're going to get to the end without anybody punching anybody. So that's kind of miraculous.
Well, and that's been a hallmark of a lot of your recent work. And again, I go back to Savior 28 as one of the main points of that story. And I know you feel real strongly about that. And yeah, that's a tough trick to do is to have conflict and high adventure without, you know, people punching each other or shooting at each other or whatever.
And that's what I meant about the Superman stories from when I was a kid. Not so much imitating the stories themselves, but they were filled with imagination. And if you look at those old stories, 90% of the time, Superman is not fighting with a villain. There's, you know, there are villains, there's interesting things going on, but it's, you know, it's sort of in a weird way reminds me of Kirby, because you look at some of those little 8-page Superman stories, and in 8 pages, there's so many concepts that they throw out that you could do a 12-issue maxi series based on 8 pages. And it's just like Kirby, where, you know, you'd read a Kirby story, especially when he got to DC in the 70s. And every other page, you could pull out a concept and write a novel about it. And he would just throw it out there, move on to the next mind-bending concept, you know?
You know, his war stuff in particular, I always loved. When he was writing The Losers and drawing it, I thought that was such a great collection of stories.
Yeah. You know, believe it or not, that's the curse that I have never read. As much as I love Kirby and I've read so much, I've never read that, and I've heard phenomenal stuff about it.
Yeah.
So have they collected that?
It is. You know, those Jack Kirby collection hardcovers. There was one of the losers. And yeah, man, and truly, it's so funny when it comes to DC, it is now not so much the horror, just because I'm not a horror fan per se, but it's the Westerns, the war comics, the science fiction comics, a lot of the anthologies. That's what I look for in the dollar bins, is a lot of that, you know, 70s and 80s stuff that was kind of near the end of when they were putting that stuff out. But truly, Kaniger and Kubert and, you know, God, Russ Heath and all these – and Kirby was part of that mix as well. Yeah. No, they're really interesting stories. And like you say, they are – most of the time it's eight pages. It's usually some incredible I'm sure to make it a more affordable book from a production standpoint, you get incredible Filipino artists and other European artists.
Right. Right.
Oh, it was just fantastic. Did you ever do any of that anthology stuff early in your career?
Oh, not the war anthology. I did only DC had one war anthology that lasted a short time. I don't even remember the name of it that I did one story for. And I was always, but I did write a lot for Weird War Tales.
Oh, very cool. I love Weird War Tales.
When I started at DC, that was how they broke you in. You were writing for House of Mystery, House of Secrets, Weird War Tales. So you learned your craft writing 5-page stories, 8-page stories. And I remember the big, big scare when I had to write a 22-page story. It was like, oh my God, can I do this? You know? And I wrote a 22-page Weird War Tales. And it was like, oh my God. And I was getting paid, I think $13 a page. And I got that check and I lived off it for an entire summer. You know?
Wow. That's awesome. Yeah. Who was your editor for those?
It was a great way to learn. It was a great way to learn. And it's funny that you talk about the war comics. Is, you know, I am so like anti-violence, anti-war. But when I was a kid, I loved the war comics.
Yeah.
Before I ever read the Marvel superhero stuff, I was reading Sergeant Fury before I ever read the superhero stuff. And I loved the Kubert Sergeant Rock and
yeah.
Who was the Native American guy? Johnny Cloud.
Johnny Cloud, absolutely. One of the original losers, certainly.
Yeah, all that stuff. I loved it as a kid. And I look back and I'm thinking, that's so interesting that I was so into that, and it's so not me. You know?
Yeah, but a lot of those were character pieces too.
Yeah, they were. It's true. They really were. And you know, Sergeant Fury, it's Lee and Kirby. What do you, you know? How can 100%. You go wrong? You know, how can you go wrong?
And Dick Ayers. I'm a big Dick Ayers fan.
That's
as well.
Right, Dick Ayers. Dick Ayers. I'm trying to think. I feel like he drew the. I think it might be the first story of mine that ever saw print. Was in Weird War Tales. It was called, are you ready for this? It was called The Blood Boat. It was about a PT boat in World War II that picks up this survivor on the sea, and the guy turns out to be a vampire.
Fantastic.
You know, all in 8 pages, kids. All in 8 pages.
Boom.
And it was drawn by Dick Ayers. You know, when I started out, it was real. A lot of those guys were still working.
Sure.
So, you know, I had stories done by Dick Ayers, by Gil Kane, Don Heck.
Wow, Don Heck.
Amazing.
Man.
You know,
yeah.
And I look back, you know, then I went to Marvel and I worked on Conan with John Buscema and I did some Hulk stories that Gil Kane drew. And I look back now and I say, how lucky am I that I got to work with those guys at all? Because they, you know, they weren't in the business that much longer after that.
Well, that's what I love about that Bronze Age era, because you're right. And it was great because it was, you know, those guys that literally can go back to the you know, definitely the 50s, if not the 40s, and still were very important creators. And, yeah, I do. I love that combination of writer and artist like that. So who was the editor of Weird War Tales back then?
Weird War Tales, Paul Levitz.
When I saw
the first script to Paul Levitz, and then started selling to Jack Harris, if you remember Jack, who edited some of the other anthology books. And then Len Wein came on staff, and he took over House of Mystery and a few of the other books. And then they launched a science fiction anthology called Time Warp that I wrote a lot of stuff for. Got to work with Steve Ditko, for God's sake.
Science fiction stories.
Working with Paul and Jack and Len, who went on to – really was my first real mentor in the business, the first guy – that said, oh, you got something special here. I want to work with you and bring out this talent that I see in you. And, you know, that's an amazing thing, something so rare. And I am forever grateful to Lynn for that. And, of course, he became a dear friend as well. So it was a great way to learn. It was a great way to learn, to just walk in and not have to be on a monthly book writing full-length stories, but to, you know, to tell a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and a character arc, and a, you know, a plot that really worked, all in 8 pages. You know, now sometimes people go on for 6 months, and you go, where was the story? So yeah. I think everybody should learn that way. Everybody should just be, you know, start on short stories and then build out. I remember when I went to Marvel and I was like, oh my God, I got to do a full length story every month. What am I going to do? I ultimately figured it out, but it was very intimidating.
I noticed, and you know, one of your great works beyond your monthly Marvel work and your monthly DC work, and you know, we have in the past talked about the Bwahaha days of Justice League and some of your great classic Marvel runs that we even earlier mentioned. But Moonshadow was always this great moment. And, you know, the direct market was never shinier and more impressive as a reader walking in. And it's like, God, it's a whole store of comics. This is incredible. Yeah. And there were so many great prestige productions. And you and John doing Moonshadow was one of those event comics that it's like, this is something different and so powerful. And I'm really excited that a definitive edition is coming out next year.
Yeah, next year, I think in March. And I'm not allowed to say from who because they haven't officially announced it. Although if you go look on Amazon, you'll be able to see because they already put something up on Amazon. But it's going to be an Ultimate Edition, a hardcover. I've been through all my files. I found my original handwritten notes, old scripts, old proposals, lots of great stuff. So it's going to be really – will be the Ultimate Edition of Moonshadow. And that really was the series that – that transformed me as a writer because I got to step outside of the Marvel and DC universes and just write the way I would write a novel, and it freed me in a way I had never been freed before as a writer. And then I, you know, from that moment on, I continued, whether it was with Epic or Vertigo or Paradox Press, to always to make sure that I had my own creator-owned stuff going on, because it's that balance that I've needed as a creative person that's kept me in the business this long. I can't just do superheroes. I need to do other things. So I've been, you know, and then get to do the funny stuff with Keith, the personal projects, autobiography like Brooklyn Dreams. And now I'm really happy because I'm working with Karen Berger again. I got a new series for her Berger Books line that comes out next year in February called The Girl in the Bay. So it's like going back to my Vertigo roots. And really just having such a great time with that as well. So the opposite end of the spectrum from Impossible Incorporated. But that's the fun of this business. You know, comics aren't one thing or the other. Comics are everything. And I feel very lucky that I've been able to tell all different kinds of stories over the years, not just one kind of story. I know there are certain people out there that they love superheroes so much, they're really happy if that's all they ever do. And that's great. But I've never been that guy. I've always had to do something different along with it. And so I'm very grateful that I've had the opportunities to do it. And sometimes you have to create that opportunity yourself.
You know, I've been having that same conversation with others, even in broadcasting, that are worried about, you know, consolidation and where's broadcasting going. And Dana Gould, the comedian, on his podcast talked about that. And it's a life lesson that I've shared with others as well in terms of don't wait for the job, your dream job. Create your dream job. You can make it yourself in this current environment. And also, again, you were thinking along those lines literally 30 years ago, 35 years ago. Yeah. And I love that because I like to compare a lot of your peers. The pinnacle was working for DC and Marvel. Mm-hmm. That was the high mountain point. But again, going back to the 80s, and like you said, things you did for Epic, things that you ultimately did for Vertigo and the like, you were thinking about creating your own stuff then. And now I always see for younger creators, DC and Marvel, somewhere between college and that first important career job, because they kind of learn craft and structure. They've got heavier editorial hands. They have to play within the rules of the respective universe. Mm-hmm. And then once they learn their craft and gather their audience, they can do an Image book. They can do a book with another publisher and take that audience with them.
Right, right. And then there's also the reverse, too. I see a lot of guys that start with indie comics and then make the leap over to Marvel and DC as well. But the opportunities are out there in a very broad way now. You know, Epic was, you know, that stuff was just starting back then.
Yes, tell me about Epic, because I always ask people, and unfortunately sometimes I pick a person, well, I only did one story, and it's like, oh, okay. So as someone who really was in the Epic world, tell me about Epic Illustrated.
It started with Epic Illustrated, and then they launched the Epic line of comics as an offshoot of that. And it was just, you know, the 80s were like an incredible time in comics, because it was just exploding with creativity and creative freedom in ways that the business never had before. That's when royalties were also coming in. So, oh, my God, we were really making a living for the first time, you know.
I hear you. Yeah.
You know, I'd only really started, you know, I sold my first scripts in the late 70s, but I only really got traction in like 1980 or so.
Okay.
You know, Moonshine, and so DC had started doing things like, I guess they were doing Ronin with Frank Miller. They did Camelot 3000. You know, Marvel had launched the Epic line. They did Dread Star, I think was maybe the first thing they did.
Sounds right.
For Starlin. And it was like, there's all this great stuff going on, and I have all these ideas. I have to do this. It reminds me, it's kind of like what the 60s must have felt like for rock and roll. You know, all these bands creating all this stuff, and you'd look over there, and look at what Alan Moore's doing over there, and look what Jim Starlin just – I got to get in on this, and I got to put my album out, you know? And that's kind of what Moonshadow was for me. I have to have my voice heard, not my voice filtered through Spider-Man, but my voice. And the great thing was, Epic was, you know, was run by Archie Goodwin, who was nice a guy and as skilled an editor as ever. And we had people like Laurie Sutton and Margaret Clark and Dan Chichester were the editors working on staff. But their job was not to impose their will on us and put their vision on our work. Their job was to create a grounding for us to be free to tell our stories in exactly the way that we wanted to tell them. And not get in our way and help us in any way they could. So it was really, really, really a really free atmosphere. And I did Moonshadow, and then we followed it up with Blood right after that with Kent Williams.
Yes.
And it was just a phenomenal experience there. But I have to say the 80s in general kind of felt like that. You know, the 2 years I did on Dr. Fate at DC was in a way as personal a run of comics as Brooklyn Dreams, which was autobiography, you know, because – they gave me the freedom to take that book and bend it and twist it in any way that I wanted to, and nobody said boo. When I did Craven's Last Hunt, and I could not have done Craven's Last Hunt had I not gone and done Moonshadow first, because that cracked me open as a writer, and I took all those lessons and brought it over. But I don't think anybody changed a comma in that story.
That's great.
You know, it was just, and that was sort of the atmosphere. It's like, be creative, experiment, be daring, go for it. The comics, we had great editors that we worked with, but the comics really was more from the creative people up, as opposed to in recent years, I feel like the business, for better or worse, it's, you know, it depends on your perspective. It's from the top down a lot more.
Sure.
There's a lot more coming from the top down. But that's just my experience. You could talk to another writer who might have a totally different experience.
I think your case is kind of typical because I think because of the scrutiny of the rest of the company, I mean, that's the thing. I think for a long time, Warner's just kind of let DC do its own thing. And I really got to talk to Paul about the DC implosion and how he was able to save the comic book line and kind of tell the bigwigs, hey, think of us as like a little laboratory for intellectual properties, and you know, we might create something that, you know, you saw what we did with Superman or the success of Superman. Maybe there's other things that might be valuable to you that are coming out from here. And now it really is hand in hand, and certainly with DC's move to Burbank,
yeah,
it's very much part of Warner Brothers' full structure. So I get it, and the same goes for Marvel too. I mean, you know, I understand why, but you're absolutely right. I think it is very, very different. So, but again, you're able to adjust because, you know, you're an old pro and you understand the rules.
Yeah, you have to adjust, and everything is different. And if you want freedom, then complete freedom like that, go do your creator-owned book and have fun. You may not make as much money or any money, depending on how the project goes, you know.
Sure. But
you will get to express yourself in as free and unfiltered a way as you can in any medium, really. And then there's the joy of working on those other characters, which even after all these years is still a joy for me. You know, that's doing the animation over these years. Between the comics and the DC animation, I think I've gotten to write just about every DC character in existence. And it's still fun. It's still fun. You know, I did two different Batman movies, not to mention, you know, working on Batman Brave and the Bold and Justice.
Two great Batman movies, by the way. We've talked about them before. Yeah. Go on.
You know, so I like playing in all these different fields, and that's the fun of it. And I think as a freelancer, but any advice for a freelancer, I would say, remember the operative word is free. You have to always, you always have to keep these opportunities, all the balls rolling, all the balls in the air, because you never know as a freelancer when that door is going to shut on you. Because you could be, and I've seen it in my own career, you're the fair-haired boy on Monday, and on Wednesday you're out the door, and you don't know why you were the fair-haired boy, nor do you know why they threw you out the door, you know? So you always have to have something else cooking. So I like to be diverse in terms of the comic book work that I do. I always like to make sure I'm doing, you know, TV or movie work and other things. I've written novels. You know, you have to, you just have to keep all the doors open, because it really, I've seen it in my own life. It changes sometimes just on a dime, unexpectedly. All it takes is some new person steps into a position that wasn't there before, and for whatever reason, they don't like your work as much as the last person did, and then there's no work anymore.
Yep.
So you cannot – I always say don't have loyalty to a company. Have loyalty to the people that you work with. Have loyalty to your editors at the company. Have loyalty to the artists that you work with, the colorists, the letterists that you work with. But I think the concept of being loyal to Marvel or to DC or to any company, I'm not singling them out, is almost absurd, because what does that mean? I just, in my time working in the business, I've seen 100 different versions of Marvel come and go.
Sure.
And different versions of DC. It's just this sort of, you know, huge machine or this beast that keeps moving on and changes its colors, and there's different people there, and suddenly it's a completely different company, but it has the same name, but it's not the company that it was 2 years before. So you can't be loyal to a company. You have, but be loyal to the people that you work with. That's you know, and keep all the doors open. Always keep the doors open, and do as work in as many different fields and genres as you possibly can.
Well, and again, the proof is in your work and the projects that you're working on. Now, before we go into some other stuff, you mentioned Girl in the Bay. What can you tell us about it?
I can only tell you the premise.
Okay.
And I think it's a great premise. It's an idea that I've had floating around in my head for a few years now. Starts in 1969 in Brooklyn, in my old stomping grounds. And, you know, Karen and I know each other from Brooklyn before either one of us worked in comics. So this story means a lot to both of us
because
of the Brooklyn thing. Although it takes place in an era before us, it takes place in 1969. This girl's an 18-year-old girl who, back in the days of sex and drugs and rock and roll, and is hanging out at this bar one night and meets this guy, and they go out to Sheepshead Bay. They're standing on the dock by the bay. And long story short, he pulls out a knife, he guts her, and he throws her in the bay.
Wow.
While she's out of her mind on LSD at the same time.
Wow.
That's a big
jump from Impossible Incorporated.
Yeah, we're definitely in different territory now.
That's cool, man. No, that's amazing. Wait,
so then here's the
–
so she manages somehow to come up out of the bay. She doesn't know how. She staggers across the street back into the bar to discover that it's not 1969 anymore. It's 2019. And then she discovers that in these 50 years that have passed, someone else has lived her life. There's a 68-year-old version of her, you know, with children and grandchildren, who's lived an entire life in the 10 minutes that she feels like that she's been floating, gutted in the bay.
Wow.
So that's the setup. That's the mystery. And then we explore that. It's a 4-issue series. And again, this will tell a complete story in the 4 issues, but there'll be enough interesting open threads that there is a lot more to explore after that. But I'm working with a new artist named Corinne Howell. She's really, really good. And it's so great to be working with Karen again. Aside from being one of the best editors in the business, she's one of my oldest and dearest friends. We've known each other long, for more years than I'd care to count, as the cliche goes. Karen was 17 years old when we met. So that's how long we know each other.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic.
Yeah,
hey,
yeah.
I've always been impressed by Karen. I only had one opportunity to interview her. I'm hoping they've dangled her in terms of, well, give it a little more time and we'll get you, Karen. I'm like, well, I hope so, because I certainly have more to ask her. And yeah, I've always had tremendous respect. So glad that she is back and doing these very interesting books. Is this through Burger Books? That's her imprint through Dark
That's
Horse.
That's her imprint
right?
at Dark Horse. Yeah, exactly.
Very cool. That's excellent, man. No, and I'm glad that Mike Richardson is giving her the platform that was taken away from her, as I shrug it, because that's kind of what it was. And as you said, you can't be loyal to companies. You have to be loyal to people.
Right.
Didn't make sense. And I'm glad, again, Karen is a force out there. And as a great editor, always a great eye for talent and good concepts. And I love talking to some of the great Vertigo editors over the years. And I'm like a guy that's no longer at Vertigo, Will Dennis, who I have tremendous respect for his eye. And now that he isn't at Vertigo, I get to talk to him more. And I felt the same way about Axel Alonso when he was at Vertigo. I mean, there's just a lot of great editors.
Oh yeah. Shelley Bond, who I work with a lot.
Shelley Bond, a perfect example. I love Shelley.
And you know, the great thing with Karen is, and I take a great amount of personal pride because way back in the day, I was up at DC one day when I was just starting out, and Paul Levitt said, you know, I'm looking for somebody to be my assistant. This is when he was editorial coordinator. So he's looking for somebody to work more on the scheduling side of things. And
okay.
I said, you know, I have this friend. She just graduated from Brooklyn College with a journalism degree. And he said, well, send her up here. You know, so I sent Karen up there, and the rest is literally comic book history. And so I take great pride in seeing what Karen has built over these years. You know, she, and practically from day one, she had her own unique perspective, her own point of view, her own vision, and she built on that brick by brick and really, really built a corner of the comic book universe that's very distinctly hers. And I am very proud of her.
I agree more.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, a couple years ago,
you know, I'm proud of her in a different way.
A couple of years ago, she and Paul sat down at San Diego and had a great one-on-one kind of look mm-hmm. back at her career. And yeah. It's a tremendous interview. Jamie Covell, another great guy who runs around the conventions and manages to capture some great convention panels. He has a website, and I've mentioned it before. I'm just telling you and I'm telling the listeners, thecomicbooks.com. And you can find he's based in Canada. Because he does go to a lot of the Canadian conventions as well, TCAF and Fan Expo and the like. But he's always at San Diego and always has literally two dozen panels in those 4 or 5 days. And it's just him constantly running tape and having the agreement that, you know, he can release those and stuff. And, you know, and because you've been a part of these as well, these one-of-a-kind conversations that if you're not there, you miss it.
Right.
So that's a great example of Paul and Karen talking about Karen's career. Right. I'm excited, man. That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
And again, sounds like DeMatteis to me. Sounds like Aaron Berger to me. So that's excellent, man. Very excited about that.
I'm excited about it creatively and personally getting to work with Karen again. It's been a blast.
Excellent.
And I have a ton of other animated stuff that's been going on this year, none of which I can talk about.
I'm glad to hear it, though, we will talk when we can.
Yeah, I've done three episodes of Marvel's Spider-Man. The first one is aired, but I have two more waiting to air whenever they
– terrific.
Not, when they're launching the next season. But I've done – and aside from that, I think three or four other DC-related projects. I'm in the middle of one right now that have all been really, really fun and interesting and exciting. And hopefully when they come out, I'll come back and we can talk about them.
Hell yeah. Well, and honestly, Mark, I'm really glad that you're doing that because, as you know, we all get excited as fans when the animated movies really do capture the spirit of what we love so much in the books. And obviously, a lot of times that happens because certainly Len was another writer like that when he got to do animation. God, all the guys. And I don't remember. I know you did your Justice League stuff, but I don't know if you did any Batman animated series stuff back in the day.
No.
Okay.
I came into it right around the time of Justice League Unlimited, so I did a bunch for that. And Batman Brave and the Bold and the animated superheroes and a bunch of other stuff. Yeah.
In Justice League, and I know for a fact you did the Fourth World one. That Starenko plotted, and then you
did
the script. That was amazing. But am I right also, didn't you adapt for The Man Who Has Everything?
Yeah, that was the first one I did for them.
Ugh.
That was the first one I did for them. And I'm embarrassed to admit this, But I had never read that story.
Wow.
And then they, you know, because everyone in the world knew that story. So I think had I read it, you know, before, I would have been very intimidated adapting it. But it was like, here's this Alan Moore story. And they sent me, you know, and okay. And we worked on the adaptation. And so I wasn't as intimidated as I should have been when I adapted it, which I think is a blessing in disguise. Oh. But yeah, that was the first one I did for them. And happily, it turned out well. So there were lots more that followed. And, you know, and then it's again, we talk about the creator-owned books where you're really – it's just you and your artist basically working on your own. You know, when you're working in TV and movies, it's a whole other thing. And I take off my sort of auteur hat, you know, and I put on my collaborator hat because you're working with a lot of – there's always a lot of people involved when you're working in TV.
Sure.
And so I get to work with, you know, great guys like Michael Jelinek and Jim Krieg and Bruce Timm and you know – so many people, Peter Girardi over at CWC, and then I'm forgetting like lots and lots of great people.
James Tucker, have you worked with James?
James Tucker, yeah, thank you.
Love James. James is great.
Tucker
and Mike too.
Yeah, they ran Legion of Superheroes and Brave and the Bold. Brave and the Bold, I might have enjoyed that show more than any of them because it was just so much fun, you know?
They approached me to come on, which was in itself flattering, and they're like, John, I don't know if you've watched it, but really, it's like the Golden Age Batman. And I'm like, oh, that's great. I'm in. And they're like, that's really in our minds. That's what we're doing is like the adventures of the Golden Age Batman. And I'm like, that's terrific. And I did. I fell in love with the show immediately.
Yeah.
Felt the same way about Superboy and the Legion. And then, of course, you and Mike worked on the Thundercats show. And I'm not a normal. I was too old to be a Thundercats fan. But a good friend of mine who's about 10 years younger and now in his 40s, he's like, dude, I know you don't like the Thundercats. I swear to God, it's some of the best writing and animation you've seen ever. Did they only make one season of that?
Yeah, they did. And there were a couple that I wrote that never got on the air because the show was canceled, you know? And such a beautiful job. And I was also not a big Thundercats guy, but I have a son who, you know, grew up with that stuff.
Okay.
So I had an appreciation for it, but I wasn't like immersed in it. But they took that original series and they stayed true to it while completely recasting it in a newer and bigger and better way. They did Jelinek and whoever else, I don't remember, worked on that show. They just did such a great job with it. And that show could have gone on for years. But what I've also learned over the years with a lot of this animation is the half hour action adventure stuff is that if the toys don't sell, that's it for the show. You know,
I do.
And unfortunately that's the way it works. One show that I never got to write for, but I loved as an audience member, was the Green Lantern animated series.
Yep, absolutely.
I heard the same thing about that it didn't sell, so they killed it. And that was a great show. Oh my God.
I was just on another comic book podcast. I was flattered they wanted to talk to me. And I talked specifically about that because there was a different comic book podcast out there that was just tearing their hair out and didn't understand why it wasn't getting renewed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's I went on their message boards and explained that very thing because I've had enough people like yourself that come from animation. And it's that simple. This is made for a Y7 audience to sell toys. If the toys don't sell, it could be Gone with the Wind and Citizen Kane. They don't care.
Right.
They are dumping it and going on to the next thing. And really, this podcast audience and the hosts are like, oh, but it got a great adult audience. I'm like, yeah, that doesn't matter. It has to matter. It's eyeballs. It's ratings. I'm like, it's not the ratings or the money they're looking for because we're not buying the toys.
Yeah.
And the kids aren't buying the toys.
Yeah.
So it's going away. And you're 100% right. That show was incredibly well written and really smart. And again, be thankful, as I'm sure you are, with the Thundercats and some of these other things. It's like, hey, we got 13. In the case of Thundercats, we got 13 episodes. Yay!
Yeah.
I mean, that's an achievement. And the same thing with the two seasons of Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes. I never thought there'd be a Legion of Superheroes cartoon, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, and the second season, they really found their voice. In the second, first season was really good, but the second season was even better, and they were just building momentum. And I think I worked on the finale of the second season, and you know, there were a lot of places they could have gone from there. The other big animation disappointment I had was there was buzz for a while that they were going to transition Brave and the Bold into a JLI show.
Ooh,
and I wrote a couple of Brave and the Bolds with the JLI characters in it, which was really, really fun. And that just would have been, you know, JLI is made for animation. They could just
of
do
course.
So much with with our version, with our characters. So that was a disappointment. But that, you know, it's TV, it's like comics, you know, you're working on your favorite series and they cancel it. You're working on your favorite show, they cancel it. And it's even, you know, it's a heartbreak when you're the audience, but it's even more of a heartbreak when you're creating the thing and it gets canceled.
I understand, man. I thought you really had something great going with Justice League 3000, you and Keith.
Yeah.
And I got to ask, am I hearing right? Is Scoopy Apocalypse wrapping up?
Oh, is that out in the world now?
Well, I saw – well, you know, Bleeding Cool, our own, you know, Daily Tattler. It looked like it was looking like it was last issue coming up.
You know, I mean, what's the difference at this point? So get in on the last bunch of issues because we're going to wrap up the whole story. We're not going to leave it hanging. We're going to wrap it up. So wow. I think issue 36 will be our final issue.
Hey man, 36 issues and
yeah, and this market? Are you kidding? That's fantastic.
And I got to be honest, Mark, I was such a doubter about this new direction for all the Hanna-Barbera stuff because I'm like, why are you going off model in the more extreme cases like Mark Russell's Flintstones mm-hmm. and some of these other things. And then I started, you know, first of all, the one shots of the team ups. Did you work on any of those? Like, you know, taking a hero and a Hanna-Barbera.
No, what I just did was they just did a whole like another four of them, and I did a secret squirrel backup that ran in the back of all four issues.
Oh, that's great!
Yeah.
I have a couple issues. I haven't opened them up yet,
yeah.
And I might have to get the ones I didn't pick up to read your whole story. That's fantastic.
But I'm with you. I felt the same way. You know, Keith called me up one day and said, "So, you want to do Scooby Apocalypse with me?" I'm like, "What?" But I always say, you know, when it comes to Keith, if he called me up and said, "Want to do Millie the Model with me?" Of course, I'm going to say yes because when I work with Keith, it's the collaboration even more than it is what we're collaborating on. Because I know when the two of us get together, we can have fun and create good stories with just about anything. And then Scooby turned into a great gig. Keith left the book, and I'm going to do the last batch of issues, write them myself.
Okay.
But we're trying to really give the readers an ending, so it's not just like you're not left in the middle of something. You know,
cool.
we have this world, we have the setup, we have the nanite plague. We're going to resolve all that by issue 36.
That's excellent, man, and I'm glad they're giving you the space to.
Yeah, they gave us a lot of warning on this, so that there's room. There was actually room because sometimes you know they tell you. I've had books where like it's like okay, you got an issue or two, and you're done.
Right.
So you don't have time to do something like that and give the readers a satisfying ending. This they gave us enough warning that I hope I will be providing a satisfying ending, and if I don't, it won't be for lack of trying.
I understand, Keith. I know he's got a lot of other things coming up. Are you doing anything with him?
Not at the moment, but you know, we always end up doing something else together. You know, I like to say we did those 5 years on Justice League, and then didn't work together for 10 years, and then we got together with Kevin, and we did Formerly Known as the Justice League, and we all went,
yes,
oh, we should really keep working. We had no clue working on the original Justice League run that it was anything that we were anything special together.
Oh my God!
These three idiots, 10 years to go. Oh, this is really good. We basically, in one form or another, kept working together on various projects, especially with Keith. But I've done, you know, we've done projects with Kevin along the way as well.
Yes.
And I would work with either one of them again in a heartbeat. If someone called up tomorrow and said you want to do a project with McGuire, I wouldn't care how busy I was. I would jump at it. And the same thing with Keith, because I just love working with those guys. And again, it's like what I said with Cavalero at the beginning. You know, you work with people that are really talented and really creative, and then they're really good people too. What else could you ask for?
Yeah, you know, McGuire is such a good guy, and I've gotten to meet him a couple times
in the
last couple of years. And unfortunately, much like Giffen, it's like, yeah, I'm probably not going to get him on a podcast. I'm so pleased that I did get Keith when he was still open to the idea.
Oh, you did get to talk to Keith, though. That's good.
One time, 2005 or 2006.
Oh, you should try to get him. Keith is as entertaining as they come.
Oh, I know.
It's like, you know, sometimes I call up Keith and I just have to be quiet and listen to a 30-minute stand-up act because he just gets going and he's really smart and he's really funny and he's so hugely entertaining. And Kevin, in a totally different way, is the same way. Kevin is very smart and very funny. I hope you could get him on because he would be incredibly entertaining and insightful.
Oh, I'm hoping he'll reconsider. He, you know, and I even, you know, he's become really good friends with Bendis. I think he moved out to Portland now.
Yeah, a while back.
And so they're, so not only do they collaborate, but they've become really good friends. And yeah, and Brian's like, I'll put in a word for you and everything. So I'm like, okay, well, we'll see. And he was just like, you know, he just seemed like he didn't want to, you know, podcast at all. And just seemed kind of self-conscious about that, which is too bad because, as you said, Tony Moore used to have this great convention in Cincinnati. And I got to spend some time with him hanging out there. And he was really funny and loose and everything. And I'm like, oh, man, I hope to get you on the podcast sometime. And like I said, unfortunately, I did. I just saw him in New York. And he's like, eh. I'm like, all right, man, I'm not going to pressure you. I'm soft sell. Don't worry about it. There's plenty of other people to talk to. And Giffen, yeah, I don't know. I've got his number, and I'm going to have to try because I know he kind of is a bit of a – or at least – from a public standpoint, I don't even know. I'm sure he's got a DC email or whatever, but like, yeah, I all I have is his phone number and other people at good comic book blogs that do have a connection with him are like, you know, a lot of times you just have to call him and be ready. And he'd be like, I can't today. Or if he can, he'll be like, all right, let's do it now. And it's like, okay. And I would be prepared for that because, man, I'm excited about the thing he's doing with Lemire.
Yeah.
That's kind of Stranger Things for the DC world, basically.
Yeah, and he's drawing again, and it's great. I mean, as much of a fan of I am of Keith as my co-writer, I'm a huge fan of his art. I love I love his art.
Yeah.
So I'm really happy that he's working on that and drawing again.
Excellent, man. Hey, and real fast to wrap up, you know, I know you've been doing a lot of writer seminars, and I think there is a few better to learn from as far as craft and that. Are you still doing it? Is that still coming?
I haven't done one in a while, but I just decided recently that I'm going to do another one in the spring.
Great.
And so if anyone's interested, you can go to my website, jmdmateus.com. There's a section for workshops, and probably early in the new year I'll be putting up information about when and where exactly this will all happen. Because I haven't done it in a while and I miss it. I really have fun when I do it. I did something a few months back. I went up to there's an Activision studio not far from where I live.
And, oh, wow.
And did a day long kind of seminar / workshop with them talking about story all day. And it reminded me how much fun it is to just sit with a group of people, you know, in the case of my workshops, for an entire weekend and just talk story and impart whatever wisdom I have, and I always end up learning as much from them as I'm imparting to them. So it's always a great experience. So I hope to get another one going in the spring. So if anyone is interested, just check the website. There's also an email on the website, so you could always email me directly with any questions. And I'm looking forward to doing another one.
That sounds great, man. So Impossible Incorporated, we're mid-story right now. Third episode issue is coming out next week from IDW. In February, The Girl in the Bay, sounds amazing, from Berger Books, the Dark Horse imprint.
Right.
The Constantine City of Demons movie, animated movie, you saw it on the CW. Get the full movie, more scenes, it's on sale now. And Moonshadow, we're looking forward to that coming in 2019. Full slate, man, and more animation and other projects from Mark DeMatteis.
It's, that was a great summing up, John. You're very good at your job.
I'm looking at your email. It's all written out for me.
I see. But, okay.
You know, I'm a fast read. I'm a fast copy reader.
That's good.
Dude, no, always great talking to you. Seriously,
yeah,
man.
Talk to you too.
Well, and truly, as another freelancer out there doing their thing, you're one of my inspirations. So truly, I'm glad that things are going well, and I will do my best to follow your lead.
Okay, great. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
As always, a tremendous conversation with Jam DeMatteis. I got to pinch myself sometimes when I think back to the kid I was reading these books back in the day of people like Mark. And now I get to call him friend and call them back and have them back on Word Balloon. It's honestly such a treat, and I'm always happy to share these conversations with you every week here at wordballoon.com. Like I said, in that impasse time, I hope you had a chance to reach back and listen to some of the other earlier episodes of Word Balloon, not only before the Bendis tapes, but maybe some of the October conversations or earlier. You know, the whole archive is waiting for you at wordballoon.com. If you don't see it on the iTunes feed, it's only got the first 300 episodes. I'm trying to fix that with my people at Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker to get the full 826 episodes of Word Balloon back on the feed, and don't have to force you to go back to wordballoon.com to get all this stuff. I mean, that's the eventual plan. And truly, I mean, I'm not taking nothing away from my friends at Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. They're excellent. They've been helping out, and it's been wonderful moving to that platform and continuing to do new shows there. But eventually I do. I want to get everything available to you in the most easy way possible to enjoy all these great conversations we've had over the years. It's interesting to go back and hear what was on the minds of the creators behind 52, the weekly series. You know, I mean, back when Jeff Johns didn't have a million things to do and he had an actual time to talk to me here at Word Balloon. You know, Mark Waid, back when he was still with DC. Aw, we miss him. And I know. Hopefully that relationship will repair itself. This is all me talking, and Mark has nothing to do with it. Love what he's doing at Marvel. Nothing against that. Don't get me wrong. But truly, I mean, you know, the nuances of the Bendis tapes as Brian and I became bigger friends. Dan Slott, Greg Rucka, Brubaker. I miss you, Ed. I'm getting sentimental. My fireside chats with Matt Fraction, Kelly Sue DeConnick, both of them, the power couple. I love them both. You know, I can't help it, man. It's the holidays. I'm thinking about my friends and happy to share these conversations with you, new ones and old ones. Go to wordballoon.com and always peruse the archive, because you'll find great conversations going all the way back to 2005. I had that original feed in 2005, and it switched in September of 2006. I'm old. I still say 2006 instead of 2006. But, you know, it's always great conversations, and I hope you'll check those out. And the new stuff as it comes out. More coming in December. We're barreling right through. I've already got a couple in the can that I can't wait to share with you. Conversations with Victor Gorlick from Archie Comics. Great talk. Man, do you realize Victor has been with Archie Comics since 1958 and can tell us about the prime years of Archie of the 50s to the new prime of the 21st century with Sabrina's Netflix show and Riverdale and all the new invigorated interest in Archie, the wonderful series Archie 1941. We talk about all that and more, and that's coming in just a couple days right here at Word Balloon. So hang tight. More great conversations that are scheduled and in the running in the next couple days and weeks ahead. You won't want to miss it. It will be a December to remember. I promise you that. It's my Ali influence coming on me to rhyme this way in the holidays. But it's all coming up here on Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening today. Word Balloon was brought to you by the League of Word Balloon listeners. If you enjoy what you're hearing and want to subscribe, you can do it via Patreon, patreon.com/wordballoon, or click on the Patreon ad on the front page of wordballoon.com. Thank you, League of Word Balloon listeners. The Word Balloon episode is also sponsored by Aftershock Comics. I'm sputtering now. Great hit series waiting for you at your local comic shop right now. Animosity, Marguerite Bennett, Raphael de la Tour, A Walk Through Hell from Garth Ennis and Goron Suzuka, Baby Teeth. The first 10 issues of Baby Teeth with Gary Brown and Donnie Cates in stores coming up Wednesday, December 5th. Beyonders by Paul Jenkins and Wesley St. Clair. Witchhammer, Aftershock's first original graphic novel, coming from great horror experts Cullen Bunn and Dalibor Talajic. That's in comic stores December 19th. These are great ideas for Christmas gifts. You should consider them. Also, don't forget about Pestilence from Frank Thierry and Oleg Akunev. A great book. The first trade is available now. The second trade coming in January. So that's a nice one, too. Get them hooked on the first volume of Pestilence, and they'll be looking for the next volume in just a couple weeks in early January. Pretty neat stuff, man. I am telling you, you will find great books that you like that are being put out by Aftershock Comics. Check it out for yourself. You'll find full story descriptions, preview pages, and the diamond codes on these books to order through your local shop at AftershockComics.com. Thanks again for listening. More coming up in December, and thank you very much for being patient during November. I hope I've been keeping you entertained in these early holiday weeks. More to come before the year is out. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2018.